Because all is burning. And what is that all that is burning? The eye is burning. Visible forms are burning. Eye consciousness is burning. Eye contact is burning. Also feeling, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that arises with eye contact as its condition, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust, with the fire of hate, with the fire of delusion. It is burning with aging, birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain and grief and despair. The ear is burning, sounds are burning, and so on. The nose is burning, odours are burning. The tongue is burning, flavours are burning. The body is burning, tangibles are burning. The mind is burning, mind objects are burning. Mind consciousness is burning, mind contact is burning. Also the feeling, whether pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that arises with mind contact as its condition, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust, with the fire of hate, with the fire of delusion. It is burning with birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair, I say. So that is the Buddha's fire sermon, or part of the Buddha's fire sermon. Very early on in the Buddha's teaching career, he converted 1,000 matted hair fire worshippers to be his followers. He actually converted their teachers, and all their disciples followed. So there was this sight of all these dreadlocks, which the matted haired fire worshippers used to have their hair in, and all their fire implements were floating down the river Uruvela, and now these former fire worshippers were all followers of the Buddha with shaven heads and orange robes. And they followed him. Initially they just went with him as he travelled around. And very early on in their time as his disciples, he taught them this sermon. Fire had been a big part of their previous practice. They had a very strong imaginative connection with fire. So the Buddha taught them about how all is burning, how the world is on fire, burning with the fires of greed, hatred and delusion, burning with birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. So it's a very strong image, the image of fire and the world, our experience burning in fire. We've probably all sat and gazed at a fire. Maybe an open fire with logs, comfortably gazing into the flames. Or maybe we've stood by a bonfire, a bit fiercer. We've enjoyed the warmth, the heat, the flames. We've watched them consuming whatever is in the fire, the logs, the branches, whatever. We've perhaps been fascinated by the play of the flames, the dance of the flames. We've seen them glowing and dancing, red, orange, blue, white, green. We've watched the smoke swirling and rising, and yes, within that fierce glow, everything crumbling and disintegrating. And it can be very satisfying just looking at a fire like that. But then that fire is contained. It's safe in a fireplace, in a bonfire. But when fire escapes, when it gets out of control, it becomes remorseless, terrifying. And in recent years, there have been some vast forest fires, bushfires in Southeast Asia, in North America, in Australia that we've probably all heard of. We've probably seen pictures of animals, humans, all fleeing, knowing that nothing is going to be spared. You know, the flames are remorseless. Quite a number of years ago, I sat on a hillside in northern India, in Almora, in the time of the big heat leading up to the monsoons. And sitting on the veranda of the house where I was staying, we'd look out and we'd see the forests burning in the distance, fires that had started one way or another, burning the forests, burning. And one just had a real sense of something very fierce, but there it was still quite a long way away. But one day I went out to burn our rubbish at the bottom of the garden, as I'd been doing for a while, but I hadn't reckoned on how quickly the grass had dried out. And it was only a little fire, but as soon as it was going, I started to notice these flames shooting off in this direction and that direction through the dry grass roots. And I think I must have spent 10 minutes frantically running around, sort of beating out the flames as they spread in this direction and then in that direction, knowing that if I didn't actually contain the fire, within minutes it would have run up the hillside. You know, the whole hillside would have been alight, burning just as those hills that I've been looking at in the distance at night had been burning, that the houses around where I was staying would all have been destroyed. And it was very frightening, just the thought of that. You know, I just had to be just very focused and determined to stop every little flame at that time. And in Spain, at Guadalajara, sometimes you wake up in the morning and there's a certain sniff in the air, and you look around and you can perhaps hear, you can perhaps see sort of brown clouds around, and you hear the planes and the helicopters, and you know that somewhere not far away the hills are burning, the forests are afire. And you do see from time to time as well the grim aftermath, where the blackened tree stumps and devastated hillsides. So fire, when it gets out of hand, is remorseless, terrifying, destructive. And the Buddha teaches that we are all caught in such a fire that is out of control. We're burning, we're on fire. It's a very powerful imagery that the Buddha evokes here. Another time he taught, and this is in the Maranasati Sutta, the Mindfulness of Death Sutta. There is the case where a monk, as day departs and night returns, reflects thus: many are the possible causes of my death. A snake might bite me. A scorpion might sting me. A centipede might bite me. That would be how my death would come about. That would be an obstruction for me. Or stumbling, I might fall. My food, digested, might trouble me. My bile might be provoked, my phlegm. Piercing winds and forces in the body might be provoked. That would be how my death might come about. That would be an obstruction for me. Then the monk would investigate. Are there any evil, unskillful mental qualities unabandoned by me that would be an obstruction for me if I were to die in the night? If, on reflecting, he realizes that there are evil, unskillful mental qualities unabandoned by him that would be an obstruction for him were he to die in the night, then he should put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavour, undivided mindfulness and alertness for the abandonment of those very same evil, unskillful qualities. Just as a person whose turban or head was on fire would put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavour, undivided mindfulness and alertness to put out the fire on his turban or head, in the same way the monk should put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavour, undivided mindfulness and alertness for the abandoning of those very same evil, unskillful qualities. So another image of fire, this time a turban on fire, a head on fire. I don't know if you've ever been near anybody whose hair has caught alight or whose robes, clothes have maybe caught in candles. I mean, when you see that happen or when it happens to you, you act promptly. You know, you leap into action. You know, you don't worry about knocking things over or breaking them. You know, you just act immediately. You don't waste time. There's a desperate urgency to actually putting out a fire if your head is alight or your clothes are alight. There was a 60s rock star, this is completely by the way actually, called Arthur Brown. And his group was called The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. And he used to appear on stage with his head on fire. And he used to be sort of screaming, "Fire!" He didn't last very long, as I remember. So again, the teachings of the Buddha on fire. In the Upadana Sutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, the Sutta on clinging, the Buddha speaks of this great blaze made out of 30 or 40 cartloads of timber. He said it's as if there's this great fire, and that we're ourselves constantly feeding it with dried grass, dung and timber. And it's as if we're constantly feeding the fires of our own craving and delusion, constantly feeding the fires of our own ignorance and suffering in this way. And in this way, keeping them all burning, keeping ourselves bound to the cycle of conditioned existence, keeping ourselves bound to our own suffering, keeping ourselves burning in the fires of our own suffering. So these are at least some of the teachings of the historical Buddha, the Buddha Shakyamuni, where he evokes the imagery of fire. In the White Lotus Sutra that we're looking at this weekend, and those who are staying over the next week, we meet a Buddha Shakyamuni, but it's not the historical Buddha in the same way. It's a timeless Shakyamuni, a Buddha standing out of time and history. The historical Buddha lived for 80 years, and for 45 of those years he was enlightened. He was the Buddha wandering about northern India, often in rags, dusty. He got sick, he had back trouble, he would get tired. This Buddha of the White Lotus Sutra is always king-like, resplendent. His skin shines golden, his robes are golden, his hair always brilliant blue-black, tied in a knot on his head. So he's a timeless Buddha, stepping, as it were, out of timelessness into time to teach, and appearing as a Shakyamuni, but not the Shakyamuni that we've just met in those stories from the Pali Canon, but a timeless Buddha teaching the timeless, ageless Dharma. But not surprisingly, he too uses the evocative and powerful imagery of fire. And he uses this particularly when he teaches the parable of the burning house. So addressing Sariputra, he says, imagine, Sariputra, that in a certain kingdom or city or town, there is this immensely wealthy man, now getting old, who owns many farms and much land, many houses, many slaves and servants. His house is vast and rambling, and hundreds of people live inside it. No one knows exactly how many. But you can only get in and out through this one small door. Perhaps a number of you, many of you, are familiar with the writer Mervyn Peake, and you've come across his description in the Titus Groan books of Gormenghast. I imagine this house that's described in the White Lotus Sutra to be a lot like Gormenghast, with endless rooms, halls, corridors, labyrinthine. Some of the rooms and parts of the house, the building, are long forgotten, though some sort of life lingers, goes on in them, sometimes a sort of half-life. The whole place is crumbling and falling into decay and disrepair. But no one seems to notice. The pillars are crumbling, plaster is flaking off, the walls are cracking, the foundations are shifting and sinking. The stairs are unsafe, the doors don't close properly, timbers are rotting, the thatch is full of creatures crumbling and rotting, the roofs are leaking. Yet no one seems to notice. They assume that it's all just fine, that this is the way things have always been and always will be. So this is us in our world. Civilization built on civilization, you know, quite literally, you know, one civilization built on the ruins of another, often in a quite apparently haphazard way, a great ramshackle structure crumbling even as we add new extensions, block up doors, open new windows, make our endless apparent improvements. In this house there's all sorts of creatures. Birds flap and flutter around the pillars. They nest, hunt and scavenge. Owls, hawks, vultures, crows, magpies, pigeons, sparrows, all sorts. There are snakes and scorpions, poisonous centipedes, ants and cockroaches. There are rats and mice, ferrets and weasels. All sorts of creatures are there, scuttling to and fro, all going about their business, and many of them vicious and dangerous. Well, there's plenty of life all around us, and some of the creatures around us in this world are pretty dangerous. In places, the drains have become blocked, or people have just used empty rooms or corridors as latrines or places to dump rubbish. And there's a stink of excrement and urine that keeps wafting through the rooms and corridors. Perhaps don't need to say more about that. Foxes and wolves and jackals skulk around. They gnaw at human carcasses that have been left in deserted and derelict parts of the building. And packs of mangy dogs follow them, squabbling and fighting over the bones, vicious, hungry, snarling, barking. Parts of the building have a dark, fearful atmosphere. And here, all sorts of goblins and ogres, yaksas and malign flesh-eating demons lurk, looking out for any human who might wander into their hands, battling with one another, screaming and cursing, capturing and torturing and killing and devouring any of those packs of mangy dogs that come their way. I don't really want to try and explain all this away. I'll just leave it to you to read the papers, watch the news and TV, go to a film or two, look around you. You know, it's easy to see actually what's being described here, I think. So suddenly this great building catches a light and the fire begins to spread rapidly. Demons, animals, all the creatures that live there start to panic and run to and fro, some on fire, screaming and terrified, fighting and scrambling over each other, not knowing the way out. Because the way out is very difficult to find. There is just this one door. And in parts of the building, it's complete mayhem. Then someone tells the wealthy man that all his children are in the building. They went in sometime earlier to play. So he looks at the smoke and flames. He hears the screams and shouting and crashing coming from the building, and he rushes in. And very soon he finds his children, happily playing, oblivious to the danger. The flames and the smoke just add to the fun and excitement. And the noise, that too, it just goes on in the background. A bit louder than usual, but it's just what they're used to. So when their father starts to shout at them to get out, they think it's just part of the game, more fun and excitement. Dad wants to play too now. If he tries to catch them, to take them out, they just run off. They think it's hide and seek, it's catch. He realizes it's not going to work. If he chases them, they could just get lost in the labyrinth of corridors and rooms and never get out. He could carry them out one at a time, but no more, because the door is very small. And anyway, if he got one, in the meantime, the others could be anywhere. And if the flames got too close and panicked whilst he was away, they could just be everywhere, and he'd never get them out. He tries to reason with them, but it's no use. They just don't listen. They're too caught up in their games to listen, to care, to understand. So what to do? He calls to them, "Listen, listen, guess what? I've got something for you, a special treat, a new game, even better than this one. New toys, much better than anything here. I've had some special carts made for you, beautiful carts. Who likes goats? Yes, the goat carts. Who likes deer? Yes, there are deer carts. Any for carts pulled by beautiful big bullocks? Yes, we've got those too. Okay, kids, come on, follow me. Don't get left behind. Off we go. Along here, down this way, through this little door. Are you all still here? Good, here we are. Outside the burning house, safe. He's rescued his children. And the next moment they're all clamouring round. Dad, Dad, where are our carts? Well, I'm going to leave it for Gukhya Vajra tomorrow to tell you all about the carts and the rest of the story. We're going to go back in the burning house to the children happily playing. And I'm just going to make a few comments about them before finishing. So here we all are, inside the burning house, happily or not so happily, completely caught up in our games, entranced, bewitched by them, convinced that they are real, oblivious to the danger, or somehow making another game of it. Global warming, destruction of the rainforests, rising sea levels, catastrophe, isn't it terrible? Is there anything good on TV tonight? Past the Pringles. Serbia, Kosovo, Afghanistan. Do they sell them at Sainsbury's? How much? Oh, they're cheaper at Asda, you know. Or, I'm feeling lonely. Let's play Falling in Love and Mummies and Daddies. Or, I'm a complete mess. Let's play psychotherapists. I'll be the nutter who wants to be the psychiatrist. Or, don't tell me what to do. I'll play my own game and make my own rules. So what can a Buddha do? What can a Buddha do? Someone who sees the danger, sees the madness of it all, sees the flames, sees us all burning. Burning with the fire of lust, burning with the fire of hate, burning with the fire of delusion, burning with grief, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. What can he do when he sees the madness of it all, tries to point it out to us and we're just not interested? What can a Buddha do when confronted by a bunch of stupid, stubborn kids, completely caught up in their own games, when their house is burning and collapsing around them, and they'll be soon trapped if they don't get out very quickly. Well, he says, "Hey kids, I've got a new game, a much better game. It's called Buddhism, or leading the spiritual life. It's the very best game possible. Everybody wins. Everybody's happy at the end. And there's some brilliant toys. Meditation, ethics, puja, study. It's great. The only thing is, for this game to really work, you've got to take it really seriously. You've got to pretend that your hat actually is on fire. You've got to pretend that you really are in a burning house and you haven't got a moment to waste." Which is very clever, because that really is what's happening. It's just the kids don't realise it. Okay, so who wants to play?